Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Jory Lewis. She is the author of Slaves for Peanuts, a story of conquest, liberation, and a crop that changed history. Jory Lewis is an award-winning journalist who writes about agriculture and the environment. And Jory, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Oh, thank you for having me, Hopeton.
So, Jory, what is this? What is Slaves for Peanuts about?
So that's an extremely large question. You know, Slaves for Peanuts is a very complicated book. It's a piece of nonfiction, so in the 19th century, that tells the interwoven narratives of three principal characters. And one of those characters is the peanut itself. So we follow the peanut on its journey from South America to Africa and understand like how it got involved in sort of African economies and then eventually became a cash crop exported to America and then also to Europe. The second character is, in really kind of the main protagonist of the book, is this Protestant missionary originally from Sierra Leone who establishes a refuge for runaway slaves in the capital of the colony of Senegal called Saint-Louis. And the third is this man called Lat Jor, who is the king of Kajor, a kingdom in what's now Senegal. And he's sort of like the main person standing in the way of French expansion, essentially, at the time.
What inspired you to write the book?
Well, I have been living in Senegal. I've been living in Senegal since 2011. You know, when I first moved here, I came with a fellowship and I was looking at kind of the agricultural economy in Senegal. And I was spending a lot of time in this area they call the Peanut Basin, which is where they grow a lot of the peanuts. And yeah, I tell the story in the prologue that, you know, I had this experience in a village where people were growing peanuts in this area, where, you know, there was this particular group of farmers. They were trying to create a kind of cooperative. And the person, I and my friend who I was visiting, my ex-boyfriend, who was an agronomist, we thought that this particular person should be the president of this collective. We thought he was the best sort of place person. But everyone excluded him because they said that he was a descendant of enslaved people. So that was a kind of like, you know, a little click went off in my brain. Of course, I knew there had been slavery in Africa, but I didn't understand how much like it had affected people's lives, right? And still affected the kind of traces of it were still affecting people's lives. And, you know, so from that piece of knowledge, I just kind of started looking into more about like the history of what was going on in Senegal. I wanted to answer a number of questions about why peanuts became a cash crop in Senegal. Senegal is still a top 10 producer of peanuts in the world and has been for an extremely long time. And peanuts became so identified with Senegal in general. So I wanted to answer that question, but I also wanted to understand like, what is the shape of this like internal African slavery? And like, what did it mean to Senegal itself and to the development of this cash crop?
So what do you hope readers will get from the book, or what are readers telling you they are getting from the book?
Well, I mean, I wrote this book without any kind of, like, I didn't have any larger agenda, right? Just what I told you, like, I wanted to talk about the presence of peanuts. Like, peanuts are really a big deal in Senegal, you know what I mean? Like, it's just everything. And for a while, like, now Senegal's sort of, like they've got oil and gas and there's like gold and stuff. But like for a long time, there was like no other real like form of foreign trade, right? Like it was peanuts and then later it was fish. So it was an extremely, dependent country on this one agricultural resource. So, but yeah, if I had to sort of say like broadly, my kind of other goal in writing this type of book was to bring a kind of more complex treatment to African history, to like bring a little bit more drama. Not that I'm not creating drama. I'm like uncovering the inherent drama in these stories. And I, you know, as I was doing the research, I was just like, so often, especially in the story of this, the third character I mentioned, Lat Jor's trajectory is like almost Shakespearean. And I wanted to bring that, like, both the sort of interest in empathy in thinking about these stories, like, on the level that we learn about, like, British history or, you know, early American history. Why can't we also learn about this African history?
So Lat Jor was a national hero, is a national hero to the Senegalese. And it's someone that most Americans have never really heard of. When did you first hear or learn about Lat Jor? Was it doing the research for this book?
No, yeah, like Lat Jor is like a, yeah, he's sort of well known as a national hero. He, there's a statue reported, you know, purported to be a statue of Lat Jor's horse in Dakar. So Lat Jor is like in the air you breathe, right? So like even like the newspaper, maybe every once in a while, will like publish like a little dossier about like the history of Lat Jor. He's like George Washington or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
He's like that level of national recognition. And occasionally like people come up with stories about him. So yeah, I had known about him, but I didn't, it was only like when I started doing this research that I understood, well, I started to try to like unpack some of the stories about him, right? Because when you're a national hero, you don't kind of like problematize like the actions of that national hero to say like Lat Jor was both an interesting character who was kind of recovered in the post-colonial period and made into a national hero, right? This is the kind of trajectory of Lat Jor. But that he was complicated. His resistance to the French was complicated.
And speaking of the French, that's one of the plot lines of this book is French colonialism, French conquering of Africa, the role of Saint Louis, as I would say, Saint Louis there, as the capital of the French colony of Senegal. And the thing that caught my attention from the beginning of the book, besides the great story about Walter Taylor, who we're going to get to, is that the French emancipated the slaves in Haiti who were in rebellion so that they could fight against the British and the Spanish who wanted to take that incredibly profitable colony. And then when Napoleon came to power, he re-enslaved them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very sort of like dark corner of French history people don't like to talk about, right? Already, even if you, you know, say like you grew up and a kid in France, like probably you would have heard about the abolition of 1848, but you would not have heard about this other abolition that came in the wake of the sort of uprising in Haiti. And you certainly wouldn't have heard of the secondary abolition I talk about later in the book in 1905. So there's a kind of erasure of the complexity of this history of abolition. I think we have, even in America, maybe like, I think what's actually interesting to think about is, you know, when the French abolished in the wake of the Haitian uprising, I think most states in America, or many of the states in America, still had slavery. There was still slavery in New York, for example, at the time, right? So there's this sense of which we have an idea that like there's like a kind of one march toward freedom or something, you know? Whereas like in fact, this movement toward freedom had fits and starts, and sometimes you took a few steps back to go forward, and yeah, it took a long time. It took 100 years, right?
So the refuge that for escaped slaves that Walter Taylor operated in Saint Louis, you could, and you're going to have to help me along here, but you could come there, and if you stayed for 30 days without being recaptured, then you would be free.
Yeah. So what happened is that, so the French in 1848 pushed through a law abolishing slavery in what was French land. So in Senegal, because at the time, Colonialism in Africa did not yet look like it did later, right? So it wasn't settler colonialism there. The sort of colony was basically operating like trading depots, essentially, usually right. like islands or like coast peninsulas on the coast. And they didn't really have very much.
It wasn't all fully subjugated as actual colonies, but they were controlling them.
Yeah, it wasn't settler colonialism like we have had in the United States and as they might like have later. So the French land in 1848 was really limited to only a few outposts within what we now call Senegal. So it was Saint-Rémy and this other island called Gorée, which is just across from Dakar. And then as French land extended, because it was a law, the abolition itself was supposed to also sort of follow the expansion of French land. So the French right away, even when they first passed that law, they were worried, and merchants in Saint-Rémy and Gorée were worried about their relationships with people outside of Saint-Rémy and Gorée. As they said, well, you know, people may be worried about sending their enslaved workers or their captives of various kinds to Saint-Rémy or to Gorée because they think they'll escape. So there, later there was a kind of adjustment. It wasn't a part of the law, this kind of like, I don't know how you would call it, like a kind of rule essentially, that the person who was looking to have freedom would need to come to Saint-Rémy or Gorée and stay there for a certain amount of time before being able to claim their freedom. So that's it's within that kind of like strange niche that the Shelter for Runaway Slaves establishes its kind of like outreach to help people who have come to Saint-Rémy in search of freedom, but have to wait in order to claim it.
So it's, as I read, the farmers who use the slaves for the crop, the peanut crop. And so this sort of drove that. And the French didn't want to anger the farmers and the merchants who wanted to continue to have access to those slaves to produce the crop. And so there was a lot of sleight of hand and wordsmithing going on to make it seem that it wasn't what it was by the French.
Yeah, absolutely. And that continues like, you know, into the 20th century, which is really right. kind of shocking, right? Yeah, this kind of, well, you know, maybe they're not slaves.
Or they're choosing to be slaves. They want to do this.
Right. They're like, oh, but we don't know. We can't ask what their status is. That's not our business. Right. So there is this kind of like, we don't want to know what our eyes tell us. Right. Like, that's basically what it was.
So how did the peanut crop become such an important part of the economy in Senegal?
Well, let's see. So the peanuts first was, the peanut is from South America, as I mentioned. And then, you know, I talk a little bit in the book, I sort of speculate about how the peanut might have come to Africa, probably very quickly after the like so-called discovery of the Americas. You know, already on Columbus's initial voyages, he's like looking at various types of agricultural products that he can bring back. And, you know, who knows, like maybe he did or some of his associates brought back the peanut on that journey and it eventually spread around the world. There are accounts of the peanut sort of living, a little bit all over West Africa and in Central Africa as well. Scholars think that people were growing peanuts just kind of generally, like, you know, it's a small crop and associated crop, like another vegetable, like okra or tomatoes or later tomatoes or cowpeas or something like that, just to kind of add to their sauces. And then at some point there came to be a demand for peanut oil in Europe because of a number of factors. One is this expanding hygiene revolution and this need for oil to make soap. And so that becomes one of the main reasons why French merchants especially are looking for peanut oil. So I think there's a kind of like, let's call it a, like a little marketing campaign by French merchants to talk to Senegalese farmers and say like, we want to buy peanuts. Like, can you grow more peanuts? Right. So that's kind of how it happened, how it started around like the 1830s, 1840s. It starts ramping up.
One of the things you write in the book was that slavery was nearly gone in the New World by the 1880s, but an 1886 French treaty with the Cajour Confederation would allow the country to keep its traditions and customs, a measure designed to protect slavery and in some measure the slave trade. In the peanut regions, this was fortuitous since this expansion in acreage, of course, required more laborers and the demand for new enslaved people from the interior increased proportionately. So were the native people of Senegal or that region, Cajour, and were the farmers who were enslaving the people from the interiors? Was it a combination of people?
Well, so there are a few things going on, right? Like, so I always like to explain that they will go back to the transatlantic trade, right? So the transatlantic trade is outlawed by the British and the Americans in 1807, 1808. But, you know, during the transatlantic, so slavery has always existed.
Right.
Slavery is a condition that is like almost universal, right?
Right. Like, and also real quick, like slavery always existed, but not the way it was in the United States. It was a different kind of slavery, if I understand it correctly.
Well, I would say that, slavery existed in the United States the way it also existed in other parts of the New World, right? So like also in Brazil.
Right.
Or,
right, exactly. Well, but yeah.
I always also like to say that there are a gradation of conditions of enslavement, and that gradation existed in the New World just like it did in the Old World. So but what we didn't have, what we have in America or had in America that they didn't have in Africa is of course racialized slavery, right? So like, because everybody was black, so it wasn't like, you know, black person must be slave like it was in the United States. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
There's like additional racial element. And, a more kind of, let's say, intense chattel slavery. But that doesn't mean that there was nothing sort of close to chattel slavery in Africa. In fact, there were maybe some.
Especially Northern Africa.
Yeah, there's some instances where you might have something that kind of like approaches something like chattel slavery. Right? So slavery is a kind of like complicated thing to think about, especially, you know, we have. In Senegal, and I think in many other places across at least West Africa, I can't talk about East Africa or South Africa, but there are at least two sort of categories of enslaved person. There's like what they call like the slave of the house, but it's not exactly the house slave in our American condition, but it means like someone who was born into slavery, but who that being born into that condition of enslavement meant that they usually couldn't be sold. So they were sort of treated in a different way and kind of had a like more of a relationship of, let's call it kinship, but there was still subjugation, if that makes sense, right?
Yes.
Whereas like there were trade slaves. So those were like freshly captured people who could be traded like pieces of money, as people sometimes like I use that language often in the book because it's from the archives, sort of as Latour says, you know, this person is a piece of money. So those are the two types of enslavement, but the relationship of the of these traditions, these traditions of enslavement were operationalized by the transatlantic slave trade, right? So you know the means by which people are becoming enslaved intensified during the transatlantic trade, and it ends up sort of changing sometimes the uses of enslaved people. So once that transatlantic trade ended, it doesn't mean like the means of slave production, for example, ended as well. No, of course, slaves were sort of generated by war. So there's still these sort of wars happening. There are still slaves being taken as captives of war and being sold, but being sold more on like what they call like the desert side. And often these cases were people who were coming from this particular region I mentioned in the book called the Wassalou. And then they were being sort of traded sort of up the river, kind of by Moors, and then down into Senegal. So like that's kind of what's happening. I went on a little bit of a
No. That was not a question that could be answered in 30 seconds. There was a part in the book where we talk about where you talk about French explorer Paul Soleil, who was trying to get support for a Trans-Saharan Railroad. And he wrote that the future of France was in Africa. Talk about the role of the Trans-Saharan Railroad in facilitating the production of peanuts.
Well, I mean, yeah, so the Trans-Saharan Railroad actually never materializes. So that's one thing.
They got a smaller version.
That whole sort of discussion is sort of explaining like why French people like, so they, you know, the French, it's like 1870s, this is the Third Republic, but you know, they've also just lost the Franco-Prussian War, right? So they're looking for some like ways to sort of extend their power and influence. And like in Europe, it's no longer possible, right? Lost. And so they're kind of like looking for glory in other places. And so Paul Soleil is like one sort of kind of shepherd of this idea of French glory to be found in Africa, right? So that's more about like the conquest or the eventual conquest of West Africa. They, you know, one sort of motor of that was that they felt like, okay, well, there is a kind of substantial amount of economic profit to be gained in, you know, so like Senegal, where they're growing peanuts, and maybe we could grow more things or find more things in this other place, or grow peanuts as far as you know, the Chad or something like that, right? Like, so they have a lot of ideas, but it's like all kind of wrapped up in this like search of, you know, expansion, essentially. It's kind of nascent imperialism.
But Paul, he failed several times. I mean, throughout, he kept asking, trying to raise the money, just like, you know, when they built the Panama Canal. I think I think it was a French guy, too, who was pushing for the building of the Panama Canal. And, you know, that whole sordid history of us supporting Panama with the state of Colombia. And we send in the warships to so we can have this canal built and support the rebellion of the Panama state from Colombia. But anyhow, I digress. But another thing that caught my attention was the system of credit that peanut farmers got caught up with, which reminded me a little bit of sharecropping, where they ended up, you know, basically running out of money, having to repay the loans, giving up their best seeds to repay the loan, and then getting poor seeds back when it was time to plant again. Talk about that.
Yeah, I tried to kind of over the course of the book reveal the like there are two things kind of going on. There's I'm sort of sharing with you the kind of inner life of what's happening with the peanut and the peanut economy, but also kind of showing the reader like how different forms of kind of like colonial domination like sneak in, right? You know, and one is this kind of question of debt, right? Because in a way, the peanut is kind of like amazing for farmers, right? Or especially you say like the, you know, it's interesting, then that's one of the arcs of the book, is that the peanut trade sort of demanded more labor. And so like ended up people for being enslaved to grow peanuts essentially. But over time, you know, if you had enough money to buy your own freedom, you might then start growing peanuts yourself, because it was one way to have to get specie, to get money, hard cash, right? You know, instead of, you know, trade or barter or whatever, right? So, you know, but this sort of hidden drawback was the fact that there's this system in place of, you know, where the sort of merchants and intermediaries, you know, weren't really in it to like help farmers. They were just trying to like get their own benefits. And then of course, like the market price of the peanut, just like today, we see like our markets are just kind of like going crazy. But the market price of the peanut was kind of going up and down, up and down. And when it was down, it was hard for the merchants also to draw any profit, right? So you can kind of even slightly be sympathetic to them, although they tried to kind of like, you know, cheat small farmers. So there came to be a kind of system where the merchants would, you know, sort of lend seed sometimes and then expect a repayment. It was very similar to a sharecropping system. And, you know, sometimes want exorbitant, like really like usury rates of repayment.
So let's get to Walter Taylor. I believe you say he got to Goree in 1867 or 1868.
And yeah, go ahead.
No, and of course he was one of the few African Christian clergymen. He was advocating for more African Christian clergymen to come to Senegal because of the African imams that were being developed by the Muslims that he was seeing happening in his country.
Yeah. So Walter Taylor was from Sierra Leone. Right. And what's interesting about him not just being from Sierra Leone is that his family, his parents had been, he says, saved from slave ships and resettled in around Freetown, which was a trajectory for a number of people. Like after the end of the transatlantic slave trade, the British sort of policed the ocean. And if they found rogue slave ships, they would bring them back and like settle these people into Freetown, right? Even though they might have come from anywhere from the Gambia to like Angola, who knows, right? At the time, a number of them were from what they called the Yoruba states. And Walter Taylor's parents were in fact were Yoruba from Abeokuta. So Walter Taylor has a kind of like interesting childhood growing up in this town, kind of like in the hills outside of Freetown. He goes to like very good schools, like a kind of, I would call it like a prep school essentially. You know, he has a few challenges. He ends up coming, we'll skip right over that, but he ends up coming to the Gambia, which is near Senegal. You know, it's inside of Senegal essentially. And I think from there, he was recruited by an American merchant to keep the books of his trading company on Goree, on the island of Goree, which is part of Senegal. So, and then later, Walter Taylor meets a French Protestant. So that's the other kind of sort of strangeness happening here. So not only is he a clergyman, he's a Protestant in a French colony, which is mostly Catholic at the time. And then the people, so like the people in leadership positions are Catholic mostly. And then, you know, Protestants had like a sort of terrible time in France, right? Over the years, like hundreds of years of persecution, right? So they're, you know, at the beginning of the 19th century, just kind of starting to spread their wings again, starting to kind of like move out. But then this is all against a background of communities that have already been Islamized. I always like to say that Northern Senegal had been Islamized like 1,000 years before practically, right? So it's not new. It wasn't fresh. It was hard. So it was hard for, the initial missionaries to create any converts. So that's one issue for them.
He went on a speaking tour in France in 1887, and he was also in conflict with Jean Marin, mm-hmm. who was back home there in Saint Louis, and they had different ideas. And what was interesting is how he complained about going on these speaking tours where he was having to interact with people who were asking questions about his conflict with Jean Marin and the Jean Marin's family, having people there. It was a little bit of a tumultuous type of speaking tour. It wasn't smooth sailing.
Yeah. So, well, I'll backtrack just slightly. So, I mean, Walter Taylor, I mean, he's just like, after he's ordained in 1878, And he comes back and he leads the mission. It becomes this kind of, he starts the refuge for runaway slaves. And he becomes, you know, and there's been all kinds of things like happening in the mission, like other missionaries come, they die, like, you know, others just leave. And there's just like so much sort of stuff. And at the same time, he started a kind of fundraising, you know, there's the refuge is supported by fundraising in Europe, right? In Bordeaux, and actually I can't remember, I think someplace sort of Alsace or something like that. So when he goes back in the 1880s, he's just like a Christian rock star, right? Like in these communities. But yeah, he's been having a conflict with his young colleague. This guy, his name is Jean Morin. And Jean Morin is from this really influential Protestant family. So like, I think his wife is from, like, her parents are like really influential Swiss ministers, pastors. And then he himself is like I think he's the grandson of this like Protestant minister who was probably like the most famous Protestant of his day in France, right? So like, it's like Billy Graham or something, you know what I mean? Like he just has so much influence, and so much influence within the mission. It becomes like a little bit of a problem for Walter Taylor that he has this conflict with Jean, you know?
So when you were writing the book, talk a little bit about that process. You're a journalist, you're used to writing articles. Was that process very different when you said book versus your usual process for doing research and writing as a journalist?
Well, you know, I've always been like a long form journalist. Not that like that makes it easier to write, you know, 100,000 words instead of, you know, 5 to 10.
Right? You weren't one of those if it bleeds, it leads journalists.
No, not at all. I don't. Yeah, it's not like my thing. But yeah, I mean, it's like nothing can kind of compare to, like, you've been writing 5,000 word pieces, which is a lot in journalism. Don't get me wrong. It doesn't necessarily prepare you to write 100,000. No, you know, so it's a whole different skill set. I mean, this book is, every word is based on archival sources, letters, reports of various kinds, or sometimes secondary source information from already existing books. There are myths, there are fables, there's oral history. So there are a lot of different types of things. So it's just even managing that workflow, managing those sources is really a challenge. Like, everything about it is a challenge. Yeah.
So how do you decide what's in and what's out?
Well, yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. As I explained when you asked me what the book was about, I think early on I said, okay, well, there are these three strands. This book is an interwoven story about three characters, the peanut, Walter Taylor and the mission for runaway slaves, and then Lajor and the expansion of colonialism. So like, I would kind of just like map these things out, right?
Literally map it out, like in writing or graphically or in your mind?
I had many iterations of outlines.
Okay.
Or like sometimes I would, because the book's kind of set up in different sections. So sometimes I would say, well, what should be in this section? What shouldn't be? And then I would move things around, you know, like, yeah, I mean, it just, you know, I think I did end up cutting some interesting things, because I, you can kind of tell from the book, like, I kind of fell in love with some pieces of text, right, that were interesting. And then sometimes I had to cut some things that just didn't connect as well as I thought when I stepped back, right? When I would step back and read a section or like look at something, I would say, oh, well, you know, this doesn't quite work, you know, or I think there were a couple of like myths or fables or whatever. Like I had to move on because I thought, well, they're not fully illustrating what I want them to illustrate. They're not really adding the point that I needed to be added here, right? So there's a full kind of like, you know, God point of view of like looking at the story at some point, where you just like step back and you're like, well, I got to take that out. It's not serving the narrative. Yeah. So that's basically how I did it. It was just grit, basically. Yeah.
Was your style to do the research than notes and writing very regimented, meaning, or did you say, I'm going to write and research when I feel like it?
No, well, I mean, this book, it took a really long time to write. I think.
How long?
I always forget. It's like something like 7 years. Yeah. It might be more. I think I slightly just like black out the actual date. I've looked it up many times and I'm like, no, we don't need to know. But yeah, something like that. I started doing the work for this book. And then actually, as soon as I got my book contract, the Senegalese archives closed for almost 2 years. Right. So then that kind of like, you know, so what are you going to do? You know, so I ended up going to France and I discovered this Protestant mission archives and, you know, and I used the French colonial archives also. And then there was, you know, I did a lot of other types of research, but so there was a lot of collection that I did before I could write. And then I was writing maybe bits and pieces or like sometimes something that, you know, maybe some of the things that are more like descriptive or lyrical or whatever, that those might have emerged kind of organically. And then later I was like, you know, as the years went by, you know, like, and I had to, yeah, it's true. At some point I had to, once the archives in Senegal opened, I do live in Dakar. And so I, most of the time. And so at some point I had to stop. I was like, well, I can't do any more of like that research. I need to just write. But yeah, I also had at some point a writing group. So we kept each other on monthly deadlines. And that was good because I knew I had the pressure that I needed to like show my group some evolution. So that, I think that also helped me kind of motivate me. You know?
So when you were writing the book, you were still doing your journalism at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, when you write a book for 7 years, I mean, I don't care if you had like the best advance in the world, which I didn't.
You know? I thought maybe you came from rich parents. I
don't know. No. My parents do fine, but they're not like rich by any means. But and they're retired also. So
yeah. Like, yeah. You got to make a living. I mean, every writer I talked to, they had to make a living.
Yeah. So that became really difficult for me, to be honest. Yeah. At some point I was talking to my agent. I was like, I don't know. And then I ended up getting this Whiting Creative Nonfiction grant. So that was in 2018 that I got that one. And it just like changed everything because I could, for at least, you know, a little bit of time, I could just push everything off my plate and just do that. And it, you know, kind of revolutionized like how it was working. And then after that, I got this other fellowship, which, you know, was also a lot of, I had work to do with the fellowship, but not, wasn't like having a full-time job, you know what I mean? And so then I could also work. So I had this fellowship in Colorado. I had to go take classes and do some things, but then, you know, I would have 2 or 3 days a week where I could just fully work on the book. And that was also really helpful. So yeah, writing a book like this, just, you have to just cobble together resources to make it happen. It's not easy. And it's also not the type of work you can usually do while working on other things. Is because I do long features, typically I would, you know, if I were doing a long feature, it needed to, one, be like super well paid, you know, right? And, you know, then I would have to like move the book off my plate for like however long it took to do this long feature, like a month or 2 months or whatever, you know, and then come back to the book. But like working the book, I always try to explain, it was like descending into a well, you know, or into a mine, right? So it takes time, like to even get your mind, like, you know, in that shaft going down into the mine. So you can't, it's not like you can also like write other things at the same time. You just can't, you know, you just can't.
So. Well, you're in the time of journalism where it's the whole, it has changed totally from, you know, when I was in the 80s and the 90s, and I was in the business very briefly in 1986, 1988, part of the National Association of Black Journalism, went to a conference or two for a local Black community newspaper. So the, you know, print was at a high. Now, from all I've read and all the free stuff we get online, how difficult is it to make a living today as a journalist?
Oh, I mean, It's really hard. I mean, it depends, right? If you have a staff job, you can make a living. Fine,
right? Right, but those have shrunk, right? Right. So yeah, there's still staff jobs, but the number of those available has declined dramatically over the years.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know people who still get jobs. I mean, if you have a job and you live in a, you know, if you live in New York or LA, probably you're doing okay. You know what I mean? Like, there are a lot of jobs. You know, like even a lot of people have left to go to podcasting. A lot of people left like traditional media to go to podcasting. That's like a whole growth area. But yeah, as a freelancer, it's hard. I would have to say also because I've been outside of America, I would not have been able probably to kind of adopt the same like work schedule that I had if I were in America and like having to pay like super high rents and all those things, right? So like living in Senegal, not just because it was the books about Senegal and I needed Senegalese archives, but also just having like a slightly lower standard of living allowed me to have more freedom to work on this book, I have to say. But in general, like the, freelancing is, it's not easy, right? Like it depends on like your model, right? Like everyone has to kind of like figure it out for themselves. A lot of people do, do a mix of different things, like also fact checking and other types of things. I'm not exactly sure what those other people do exactly, but I do. I still write features and I edit. So that's basically what I do.
So has this experience made you think about writing your next book yet?
Well, I mean, yeah, I want to write probably another book eventually, but I'm a little burnt out.
A little burnt out.
Like, if you've read the book, you should understand. It's like wore me out. But I think you need to, I've talked to other people who are like, oh, I want to write a book. But like, you kind of have that fire in your belly because it's like, you know, it's a long journey, you know, especially with a book like this, this kind of research heavy, like, you know, crazy book. You know, if I were to write a memoir, okay, fine, maybe, right? Like, I don't know, it might not take as long, but you just got to really like want it. You know what I mean? Like, want to do this thing.
So you really wanted it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess at some point I would, I did, you know, get like discouraged. That means 7 years, man. Like, 7 years.
Years is a long time to keep it going.
Right. But so I think I got discouraged at some point. But then I would, you know, I would get into the stories sometimes, especially like Walter Taylor's story. I was like, I have never seen this story told. Of course, historians have, right? Like, but it's, you know, it's not accessible, like it's not widely, right? You know, people don't read about it that widely. And I was like, I haven't seen this. And I was like, it needs to get out there, right? And then the peanut in general, I think both of those things. So I guess less so Latjoy, right? But like Walter Taylor and like the peanut, they both kind of like kept me going, like whispering to me in the night, maybe. I don't know.
So those of us here in America will probably be thinking now, we read your book, we'll be thinking George Washington Carver, Latjoy, and Walter Taylor.
Yeah, maybe.
That's what we're hoping for, right?
Oh, yeah. That
Latjoy. Some history. Some history there. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think so.
Jory Lewis, author of Slaves for Peanuts, A Story of Conquest, Liberation, and A Crop That Changed History. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.